are so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today's Friday, June 3rd, 2016. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my guest co-host, Denise Swanson.
Hello there.
And our control room operator, Allison Cole.
Hi there.
Welcome, everyone. World Oceans Day is coming up on June 8th, and today's show is all about animals who live in the ocean, namely fish and cetaceans. Fish in particular tend to get a bad rap. Most people assume that they're unintelligent, that they don't feel pain. However, recent research shows these to be myths. Our first interview today, which is coming up in about 10 minutes, is with Colin Brown, an associate professor of biology at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, and assistant editor of the Journal of Fish Biology. Our co-host Darren spoke to Professor Brown earlier this week about his paper entitled Fish Intelligence, Sentience, and Ethics, which was published last year in the journal Animal Cognition. And our feature interview a little bit later will be with neuroscientist Dr. Lori Marino, an expert in animal behavior and intelligence whose research is focused on cetaceans and primates. And she'll be telling us about the newly formed Whale Sanctuary Project, of which she is the executive director. And that's coming up in just over half an hour, so stay tuned. But first, let's talk a little bit about one famous fictional fish who's been getting some media attention lately. Disney's animated feature Finding Dory, which is the sequel to the 2003 hit film Finding Nemo, is coming out on June 17th. The character Dory, who's voiced by Ellen DeGeneres, is a blue tang fish, a relatively uncommon species of reef fish found throughout the Indo-Pacific region. So the reason why this movie and the whole issue of blue tang fish has been in the media lately is many experts are worried that the popularity of blue tang fish will soar due to the release of this movie. When Finding Nemo came out in 2003, it resulted in a 40% spike in consumer demand for clownfish for pets and decoration and that sort of thing. This was a problem because although clownfish can be bred quite easily in tanks and that sort of thing, they are still often pulled from the ocean to be people's pets. And obviously that causes great stress to these fish and to their ecosystems that they're a part of. Blue tang fish apparently cannot be bred in captivity at all. They're a very fragile, sensitive species. They get sick easily. Again, they're extremely stressed by being pulled out of the ocean and that sort of thing. They often don't survive. And so experts are very worried that their populations are going to decline or be threatened by the release of this movie. So there have been videos circulating, petitions circulating around social media and the internet, calling for Disney to put out some sort of educational material, or put a statement at the beginning of the movie about this, about blue tang fish, that they shouldn't be pets and that sort of thing. So do you have any thoughts on that, Denise?
I think that's a good idea that Disney does do that. Otherwise, it could be a very difficult situation for these fish that are not designed to be kept in captivity, and also for their numbers, which may be threatened by doing so.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I was reading up on blue tang fish, and apparently they live in coral reefs, similar to clownfish, and apparently they're very important to coral health because they eat algae that might otherwise choke the coral with overgrowth. And I was thinking about that. You know, these fish are so important to the health of the coral. Coral, as many of us know, is vitally important to the overall health of oceans. You know, when coral reefs die, that's bad. You know, it's very bad for the ecosystems, for the oceans in general. And oceans, obviously, are vital to the health of our planet. I think it's, you know, Captain Paul Watson who always says, if the oceans die, we die. We can't survive without oceans. So, you know, so it all kind of relates. They all relate to each other. Allison, did you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, everything relates to each other, right? So the you said that the first time this happened with Finding Nemo, it was such a popular film. Mm-hmm. And what happened with all of the clownfish, I wonder, that people purchased, obviously from pet stores probably.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean,
I just can't imagine they had a good ending.
So
just the fact of being kept in some kind of aquarium, and apparently people still use like little, you know, like those little fish bowls, because yeah. I know someone who has a fish, and she said a fish bowl, and I was quite shocked. Actually.
That is sad.
Yeah,
it is sad, and you know, it's unfortunate when films like this come out, and I think it is a social responsibility of the filmmakers to. I think it's from I remember hearing, you know, Finding Nemo, it showed children to have like love and compassion for these underwater creatures, which is good on one point, but probably more so there's more bad than good when, as you said, like so many people are going out and purchasing these fish probably for their children.
Yeah,
it's hard to take care of a fish. I remember once a roommate of mine, before I knew anything about anything, had a fish, and she wouldn't clean his tank, and it was all green with algae, and he just died.
That's so sad.
Like, just, you know, it's a large responsibility. You're responsible for a life. And
yeah,
I saw some talk on Facebook this last week, actually, of a friend of mine saying, putting a call out for help, how her fighting fish, they're apparently very popular to keep as companion animals, in quote, pets. Her fighting fish is, she says, oh, what should I do? What's the best way for a burial that isn't flushing down the toilet, because this fish, he's been floating and swimming on his side at the top for a while now. That is really sad.
Yeah.
And then a few people on there said, oh, we just flush them. Like, you know, come on, give this animal, this creature, some respect. Mm-hmm. It's bad enough that you have them already and you can't return them to the ocean. We do not live in the climate where you can just drop a fish into the ocean.
Right.
To flush a fish down the toilet, that is the ultimate disrespect and cruelty, I think. And you're right, as you said at the beginning, people do not show these animals respect. And I hope that that people, you know, will change their minds, perhaps after hearing the first interview. Like, we need to show respect.
I hope so. I mean, what's baffling to me about the whole thing with Finding Nemo is that I feel like that movie was about, you know, I haven't seen it in a few years, but I remember it being about a fish who was, you know, trying to get home to his family. Yeah. And the movie really, you know, makes you sympathize with him and, you know, his struggle, like how much he loves his dad and he really wants to get home.
Same with all those Disney movies, or this is like Pixar or something else like that. And that's the good part of them. But then they also do perpetuate the exploitation of animals, films like this.
We forget that animals have families.
Right.
Right. In so many situations.
Yeah. And they have homes that they want to be in. I mean, especially fish who, you know, live in oceans or large bodies of water. They have so much space, you know, to swim around in. And then we take them out of the ocean. We put them in these little tanks or bowls, you know, even worse.
And think it's okay just to look at them. And that I was telling you earlier that one of my spinning instructors has a fish who she loves. His name is Alfonso. Every time she talks about him every class, and every time I bite my tongue, because it's not really the environment to get into a full-on discussion. We're ready to spin pretty much, but she's chatting about him for like 2 minutes before that. And talking about how much she loves him. And then the other week she said, he tried to jump out of his fishbowl. He's trying to commit suicide. I don't understand why. I love him. Like, you're his captive. That's why he tried to jump out of the fishbowl.
Right.
It's happened before. It's not the first time a sea creature has tried to jump out of their prison that's been captive. They do that.
Yeah, it's very sad. I mean, yeah, I was struck by what I read about, you know, again, Finding Nemo resulted in a 40% spike in demand for clownfish, which is quite dramatic. And again, the experts are worried that there will be a similar spike in demand for blue tangs, which will be even worse. But what I read was that, you know, people were seeking out clownfish for pets or decoration, which is very jarring to me. I feel like there seems to be something especially wrong about using a living sentient being for decoration. But people very often do that with fish. I notice people, you know, put them on display in various situations, like they're sort of like this living, moving.
Yeah, people have, you know, aquariums as a setting in their home, right?
Right.
And they think it's beautiful to look at. You know what I used to have once, what I bought like many years ago was, it was like a little sort of aquarium tank, and it had a fake fish in it that floated around in the water.
Oh, cool.
And I used to look at that. And you didn't have to clean the tank. You just put the battery, there was a battery in it, you just turned it on, and it, and he just kind of like swam around.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Well, there's even, I mean, you know, you can get a TV of some sort now, a screen that has, absolutely, you know, images of fish. But anyway, so... See Finding Dory, don't buy clownfish or any fish as pets.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independent like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.
For our first interview today, we have Colin Brown, who is an associate professor at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. Colin is an assistant editor of the Journal of Fish Biology. For years, he has studied the behavioral ecology of fishes with a special interest in learning and memory in fish. Today, we will be speaking to Colin about his recently published paper in the Journal of Animal Cognition entitled Fish Intelligence, Sentience, and Ethics. Hello, Colin, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So could you tell us a bit about what got you interested in studying fish cognition? I'm interested in both the more sort of your personal story, like what captivates you about fish that got you on this journey, and also the broader reason why it's important for humans as a whole to have a better understanding about fish.
Well, I got interested in fish at a very early age. My father used to work for an American medical engineering firm and spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia. And I was basically following him around wherever he happened to be. And while he was having meetings, generally I was in the water snorkeling. So I basically, from 5 to 15, I spent a huge amount of my time watching fish on some really beautiful coral reefs and that sort of thing. And look, I also had a fish tank and a pond from as long as I can remember. I was very young when I had my first fish tank. And it's one incident I remember when I was a little kid with my grandmother. Actually, we were visiting a local park and they were draining the pond and there were all these fish flapping around in the mud. And I was obviously horrified being a little kid, and I ran around with every container I could find and saved as many fish as I could. So from a very early age, I had a really high affinity with animals generally.
Cool. And why do you think it's important for everyone to just have a better understanding about fish?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's lots of reasons. I mean, first of all, it's the fact that fish are the most common vertebrate on the planet. So there are more species of fish than all other vertebrates combined. So that's including amphibians and reptiles and birds and mammals. So combine all those things together and you still don't have as many species as there are fishes. So that's a good reason for starters. But fish are really important to humans as well. I mean, commercial fishing is absolutely huge. We catch about a trillion fish every year, which is mind-boggling. That's about 1,000 times more mammals that are slaughtered for human consumption. And aquaculture is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world. Fish are the most numerous pets, which might shock some people. And second only to rodents in terms of their use in scientific research. So there's lots and lots of good reasons why we should be thinking about fish.
Yeah, definitely. So before getting into some of the specifics, specific fascinating details about the cognitive and social abilities of fish, I'm interested in hearing about the obstacles involved in studying fish behaviors and cognition, because presumably it's actually more difficult to study fish than studying other, you know, terrestrial animals and other species. And you also mentioned in your paper that there's so many different species, at least 32,000 species of fish, who all live across a wide range of habitats and environments. And that, and just like you mentioned earlier, you know, fish are really commonly used in scientific experiments, used for food, and also as pets, right? And we actually don't really know much about them.
Yeah, so I mean, considering the amount of time people actually spend interacting with fishes, it is astonishing how little we know about them. I mean, part of the reason we know so little about them is that we don't spend a lot of time in the water, so it's a whole other world. And when you do spend time in the water, that what you soon realize is the physics underwater is completely different to the physics in air. So there's a lot of things, rules and regulations that apply for terrestrial animals and obviously don't apply for aquarium or underwater animals. So there's a big problem right there, and that if you try to look at some of the procedures that people have used for studying things like pigeons or rats or whatever, which are really commonly studied terrestrial animals, most of those things don't work when you're working with fishes. Obviously, A, fishes don't have any limbs, so it's very hard for them to press buttons and those sorts of things. And things like using tools is a completely different physical issue, because the definition for tool use involves using your hands, so you can't do that if you're a fish, obviously. And generally speaking, you know, you have to swing it or throw it or something, and that doesn't really work underwater either. So there's all sorts of things that just don't work. So that's part of the problem, that the physics is different, that we can't really apply the sort of rules and experimental procedures that terrestrial people would use to fishes. And the definitions just don't work for fishes. So, and there, of course, there are other problems associated with the stigma. Everybody assumes that fishes are simple, robotic, and not complex in their behavior, which is obviously not the truth.
Yes, and your paper, you describe in various parts too how the studies are actually done to observe, you know, fish behaviors, for example. So let's start off with some basics on just senses and perception. What do we currently know about fish abilities to hear, smell, taste, etc., as well as other abilities like detecting electric currents or use specific parts of their brain to process sensory information?
Yeah, so, I mean, the first thing to think is that essentially all of their sense organs perform the same function as ours, and their brain has the same six major components that ours do. So there's actually a lot of similarity. The major differences between us, and humans like to compare everything to themselves, so that's kind of a useful place to start. Humans, being mammals and nocturnal mammals, are derived from animals that only ever had two visual receptors. So they only had two cones, and in fact humans and primates invented a third fairly late on in their evolutionary history, whereas fishes actually have four as a default. So they can see colour much more vividly than we're capable of. And many species have more than four. In fact, some of the freshwater rainbow fish, I think, were up to eight or something. So just it's mind-boggling how they could potentially see colour. Now, sound is obviously a really good way to communicate underwater, because it travels much, much further. Things are really loud underwater, and it's hardly surprising that the vast majority of fish actually use sound for some form of communication. And just as there's a dawn and dusk chorus in terrestrial systems with the birds and that sort of thing, so too underwater. So that's obviously sound is a major form of communication. It's not surprising that marine mammals obviously use sound to communicate as well. Their sense of smell is also really good, and taste obviously is intermingled with that. Actually, the sense of smell doesn't work very well in terrestrial environments because the chemicals don't float very well in air, whereas underwater they go into solution. So chemical communication is brilliant underwater. And then, of course, there's a whole bunch of things that we can't even relate to, things like electroreception. So there are some fish that can not only detect minute, pulses of electricity underwater, but they can also generate electricity and use it for navigation and all sorts of things. So that's kind of astonishing. And they also can use magnetic information, so the alignment of the magnetic forces around the Earth, and even small-scale differences in the magnetic components of rocks and things like that. So there's a stack of things that they do that we simply can't even relate to. And all the things that we can do, generally speaking, fish do them better.
Wow. And so I was quite blown away by the sections of the paper on fish cognition. To me, that was just some of the most interesting studies. How is it that societies of fish can be said to have their own traditions and cultures? Mm-hmm. How do fish, for example, navigate various types of social relationships in order to cooperate or even reconcile after conflicts?
So social intelligence is one of those things that arose very early on to explain why humans have such a large brain. Of course, this is the way a lot of these good theories start. They start with, this is why humans are so awesome. And then the primatologists seized on that and thought, hang on a minute, well, you know, primates also hang out in pretty complex social groups. And then the birdos got involved and said, hey, we've got bigger groups than you do. And, of course, fish, if of all the animals, are really renowned for their schooling behavior. So it was pretty obvious from the get-go that fishes were going to have some capability of living in complex social relationships. And some of the things that they can do, I mean, immediately the first thing you have to do is be able to recognize each other, and they can do that, and they preferentially associate with familiar versus unfamiliar individuals. So that's kind of the thing that most social animals do. They can learn from each other, which is obviously important if you're talking about social learning, because if you have social learning that travels between individuals and that transcends generations, then that's basically how you develop culture. And that's true both in humans and in animals. And some of the best examples of culture are things like tool use in various populations of chimpanzees, birdsong. But in fishes, most of the information that we have from wild fishes in terms of cultural development and cultural evolution is relating to movement and migration patterns. So there's some great studies on French grunts, for example, that move and migrate daily from sleeping positions. They basically sleep during the day and they move out to specific foraging locations overnight. And the path they use is passed from one individual to another socially. And they have this, each little resting location has its own cultural route to find the foraging grounds. And if you transplant individuals between these places, they follow each other. So that's pretty cool. And there are other important implications for this. So things like the North Sea cod spawning grounds, the movement of cod to those spawning grounds is also culturally transmitted. So there are big implications if we're catching old fish, which may potentially hold that social information. And at the other end of social intelligence, there's lots of good examples of cooperation and reconciliation. So Redwan Bouchari, for example, has done some really great stuff with cleaner fish, and cleaner fish have these lists of clients that come and visit their cleaning stations, and they can classify individuals based on whether they're resident, whether they're transient, whether they're predators or not, and they treat them all differently. And there's all sorts of good examples of reconciliation between the cleaners and their clients when something goes awry. So there's some really great examples of social intelligence in fishes that certainly match most of the stuff we see in any other animal.
Colm, I'm interested in knowing about math, because you say that fish can do math. How is that? Can you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things that's pretty important for most animals is being able to tell the difference between different quantities of things, whether it's the quantity of food or the number of other individuals. In the case of fish, that's obviously important, because when they're under threat, what they want to do is go and join the largest school. So we can actually make use of that and use their schooling behavior, their natural schooling tendencies, to basically investigate their ability to do maths and keep track of objects and those sorts of things. And the work that we've done in fishes shows that the manner in which they keep track of a small number of objects and also the way they estimate large number of objects is exactly the same system that humans use. We're talking about outside of actually of using language. We're talking about psychological tools here. So that is really compelling. That suggests that the basics behind maths is something that pretty much all vertebrates are capable of doing.
And earlier you mentioned, you know, right now our conception of tool use is so, you know, anthropocentric that, you know, we think in order to use tools, you must have a hand like human. So what are some of the examples of tool use in fish?
Well, the first thing we had to do was actually try to wipe away some of the baggage that's associated with the definition of tools, because basically tool use and the definition of what a tool was originally developed for people, and then of course it was applied to primates, and obviously the system there is completely different to what we have underwater with fishes. We basically have to redefine it. Fortunately, some people like Jane Goodall, when she was originally thinking about a broader definition of tool use that might apply to all animals, she came up with some very good definitions, and that was before she started applying them to primates herself. So we basically fell back to an earlier definition of tool use, and when you allow that to happen, you find that there are all sorts of good examples. And probably the best example is archerfish, which are renowned for their sharp shooting capabilities. They basically squirt water. It's a bit like using a hose, I suppose, to, you know, clean up the footpath or something. They squirt water through the air surface interface, and they basically shoot down terrestrial insects from leaves and things above them. And the accuracy that they can get is astonishing. And that's not something they do automatically. They have to learn to do that as they grow and develop. And they also have to change their aiming capability depending on the temperature, the salinity, and all sorts of things. So it's quite a sophisticated behavior. And then we have all sorts of examples of tusk fish and related species that go around picking up big shells and smashing them as they go from side to side onto anvils. And obviously, in this case, they can't really afford to pick up a rock and use it as a tool, because that's just not going to work. The best thing to do in their case is to grab the food item and smash it back and forth on the appropriate anvils. And there are specific cleaning stations that these individuals tend to use. So that's another really good example. And there are others, some accidental ones. So there was a group that had put tags in fishes, and the fish had figured out how to use those tags to operate a food dispensing mechanism, which is completely artificial. I mean, the food dispenser is artificial, and the fact that they have tags sticking out of their back is artificial. But the fish still managed to figure out how to use those tags to reach up and pull the lever to get some food. So there's some really, really good examples of tool use in fish.
Wow, yeah, that is really amazing. So lastly, you know, it appears that despite decades of work and all these studies on fish cognition and behaviors, a lot of people, you know, both among the general public and within the scientific community as well, are still debating whether fish can even feel pain. Given all the research you've done and also all the literature you've reviewed, what can we confidently conclude about fish cognition and sentience based on our current knowledge? And more importantly, how do you think fish advocates can more effectively fill the knowledge gap that people have about fish?
So, I mean, from my perspective, the major problem is not with the science. The problem is with the gap between the science and public perception. That's the biggest issue we currently have. We're going to start with basics. And the first thing you have to realize is that pain receptors actually predate vertebrates. They go all the way back into invertebrates, and there's some really nice papers that show the distribution of pain receptions and their evolutionary history in invertebrates. By the time you get to vertebrates, and fishes in particular, basically the vertebrate system is already set. So there's minor manipulation in the details, but basically the reason you and I can feel pain at all is because we inherited those mechanisms and so forth from our fishy ancestors. So we feel pain because fish feel pain. There's a lot of debate that flares up from time to time, and that's largely because there are some very hefty consequences if we acknowledge that fish do feel pain. I mean, if you think about fisheries and aquaculture, but primarily commercial live catch fish production, they're multi-billion dollar industries, and there's going to be a serious fight before anybody caves in terms of recognizing that fish might feel pain. At the moment, our welfare legislation basically stops at the water. If you look at the United States, for example, fish are excluded from the definition of animal. They don't even make it into the animal welfare legislation. And even in Australia, where our legislation is a state-by-state basis, half of the states exclude fish and the other half include them. But even the ones that do include them exclude wild fishes. So we've got a long, long way to go. And part of the problem is that if you decided that you had to protect fish and the same welfare rules apply, how would you do that? And that is a serious obstacle both for the fishing industry, but also for people like me trying to come up with some sort of ethical way to catch fish.
Well, thanks so much, Colin, for coming on the show for World Oceans Day to speak to us about your research in fish cognition. For further information, you can check out Colin's book entitled Fish Cognition and Behavior.
Thank you, Colin.
Pleasure.
Fascinating interview. Thank you so much, Darren, for preparing that for us. You're listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, Coast Salish Territories. And now for the news.
First news item on a very unfish-like animal. This is from Veg News. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released a final ruling today that places a near ban on the import of African elephant ivory. Effective July 6th, the rule prohibits both the import and export of most ivory products in an effort to protect endangered African elephants from a growing illegal ivory poaching market. China, one of the world's largest importers of ivory, recently agreed to adopt its own legislation modeled after any new U.S. laws regarding ivory trade, and is expected to follow suit during next week's United States-China Strategic and Economic Conference. Ivory looks best on its original owners, the Humane Society of the United States President Wayne Pacelli said. Killing elephants and hacking off their tusks enriches terrorists, robs Africa of one of its great revenue generators, and denies future generations the opportunity to see these iconic creatures. The ban will halt the movement of all ivory products, with the exception of those involved in part of a traveling exhibition, household moves or inheritance, musical instruments, and antiques more than 100 years old or that contain a minuscule amount of ivory.
That's amazing. That's pretty groundbreaking news. I wanted to quickly mention one item that I had actually forgotten about since so much of our show is on fish today. A recent study that appears was just published last week has shown that farmed fish, farmed salmon, feel depression. They actually can get clinically depressed. I would encourage folks to look that up because that is, that's very relevant to what we're talking about today with fish cognition and feeling pain. Fish farms are very stressful environments for salmon, and it has an effect on their psychological well-being. Now, Green Party presidential candidate in the U.S., Jill Stein, has released a statement on the killing of the gorilla Harambe in the Cincinnati Zoo. This has been all over the news lately, the gorilla Harambe was shot dead in Cincinnati Zoo when a young boy fell in his enclosure. Her statement says the killing of Harambe at the Cincinnati Zoo highlights the need to adopt stronger legal protections for the rights of animals, especially primates. Other countries, especially in Europe, have begun to provide legal rights and protected status to primates as living beings. Non-human primates should have the legal right to live freely or, when necessary, in sanctuaries, only for medical rehabilitation or ecological assistance for endangered species. And she goes on to call for the end of zoos, for the end of primate captivity, which, to me, coming from any presidential candidate, even a third-party candidate, is pretty huge.
Absolutely. I think that is huge because people are speaking about smaller issues about this story, about, oh, it's the mother's fault, mm-hmm. or, oh, it was good that the zoo shot. But what about the big picture? And I've been actively commenting on my friends' posts about this issue because it has gone mainstream.
Yeah.
And I say, the underlying issue is, why do we have these animals in captivity?
Right.
So that's a great commentary that'll hopefully get more into the mainstream.
Yeah, I hope so.
A Florida company says it has created a synthetic dog with the hope of preventing shelter animals from being used in veterinary training. The creation will lead to thousands of animals being saved, Syndaver Labs claims. Syndaver already manufactures synthetic humans. The synthetic canine comes with a fundraising campaign. The company wants $24 million to give 20 synthetic dogs to every accredited veterinary medicine college in the world. It says the schools will receive the canines for free. Currently, according to Syndaver, vet students learn surgical skills by practicing on live shelter animals. The animals are then euthanized after the labs. Syndaver says it wants to eliminate that need.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a huge groundbreaking advancement, I think. Thank you very much for that, Denise. So my guest today is Dr. Lori Marino, a neuroscientist and animal behavior expert who has published over 100 empirical and review papers on dolphin and primate evolution and behavior, as well as on human-non-human animal relationships. She is the founder and executive director of the Kimmela Center for Animal Advocacy, as well as the board president and executive director of the newly incorporated Whale Sanctuary Project, which she will be talking to us about today. Hello, Lori, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
For sure. Thank you for being here. So first of all, can you give us an overview of what the Whale Sanctuary Project is and why it exists? How was it started and what is the organization's mission?
Yes. Well, the mission of the Whale Sanctuary Project is to create and establish a seaside sanctuary in North America for cetaceans. And by cetaceans, I mean dolphins, whales, and porpoises. And in that sanctuary, these animals will be living permanently in an environment that provides as much restoration of the natural environment as possible and as much good welfare and autonomy as possible, but also will be a place where any animals can be rehabilitated and possibly released if that is deemed possible. So it really is the kind of place where currently captive dolphins and whales can retire and lead a life that is much closer to their natural existence than they are leading now.
Lori, this is Allison here. So I was just hearing in the someone speaking about this on a podcast last week that there's the non-human rights project where lawyers are rallying to get rights mandated for certain animals around the world, and animals like chimpanzees and elephants have they have court cases right now. But I heard just last week that the reason why a cetacean animal, a whale or a dolphin, hasn't been fought for yet is because part of the mandate would be that if they were to win the case, the animal would have to be released to a sanctuary, and no sanctuaries exist so far until hopefully. So would part of your mission, I guess, be to create a sanctuary for these animals so that we can fight for these animals' rights in court?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, our mission itself is to create a sanctuary, but because none of these sanctuaries exist anywhere, we're trying to fill a gap that currently exists that needs to be filled if we are going to go forward with any of our other efforts to get some of these animals out of captivity. So as you said, the Non-Human Rights Project has gone to court for primates and will be currently going to court for elephants soon. And they would like to do the same for dolphins and whales, a dolphin and whale. They can't until we have a place where these animals can be retired if they, in fact, win the case. So this is an absolute necessity. It's not something that is just a luxury. It is an absolute necessity in order for efforts to get animals out of captivity to be successful.
Hi, Lori, Elise again. So I'm wondering, what are some of the desirable criteria for a sanctuary site, and are there any promising site locations scouted at this point?
Well, yes. I mean, a sanctuary is very different from a theme park or even an aquarium. The sanctuary has to be chosen to be a real careful balance of providing some of the things that the animal needs to thrive. So in the case of dolphins and whales, we need a large expanse. We need depth in the water so they can dive, because they like to dive. the ability to interact with the ocean and some of the inhabitants in the ocean, and a very natural kind of environment. At the same time, because it's a sanctuary and you're not just taking the animals and throwing them back into the wild, you have to care for them, you have to monitor them, they have to be protected, you have to work with them. So it's a careful balance. And we're looking at sites currently. The sites we're looking at are along the West Coast in the B.C. and Upper Washington area, and on the East Coast in the Maine and Nova Scotia area. And depending upon where a site is, that will determine to a large extent the kinds of cetaceans we can take in. Right now, we're focusing upon orcas and belugas.
That's fantastic. So, and I read on your website that these would be open to the public for limited visiting hours. Is that right?
Yes. All sanctuaries have to have some public display component, and that will be true for ours as well. But it will look and feel very different than a theme park or an aquarium. The animals will be kept at a respectful distance. There will be visitors who will be able to see the facility, see the animals, but from a distance. And what's very exciting is that we will have an educational and outreach center right on site, where we will be able to employ state-of-the-art technology to really educate people about who these animals are and why they need to be in the ocean. So we're going to be providing authentic information about who they are.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I find that prospect very exciting, because you're right, there's nothing like that that exists at this point. So how long will it take to design and build the whale sanctuary? And can you give us an overview of some of the components that will be involved?
Oh, yes. It's a very complex task, as you might imagine, because we're building the first one. And so because we're building the first one, there is a lot of invention here. At the same time, the people that are on our team are very experienced with a lot of the skills that they need to bring to the task. So we anticipate 3 to 5 years. If all goes according to plan, will be the opening of the first sanctuary. And as you can imagine, this involves marine mammal scientists and veterinarians, caretakers, trainers, engineers to engineer the actual facility itself, and business people, as well as educational people and conservationists. So, you know, this is the kind of project that involves convergence and a working together in a real multidisciplinary kind of way.
That's fantastic. So I'm wondering, are there any pervasive myths about cetaceans or marine mammals that you tend to encounter often in your work? And what do you wish that the public understood about cetaceans?
Oh, yes, many myths. And, you know, as you know, dolphins in particular are really, you know, subject to all kinds of myths. And they've been a mythological animal for thousands of years now. One of the myths that I encounter is that dolphins in particular have some kind of special healing powers or some magical powers or, you know, that they want to treat our illnesses and heal us. And so people do things like go to these swim programs with captive dolphins or dolphin-assisted therapy. And I've done a lot of research on this, and it wouldn't be surprising to learn that, you know, there is no evidence that there's any kind of treatment or special abilities or powers that dolphins have to heal human beings in any way. And when you visit these animals and go in the water with them and quote, interact with them, you're really impinging upon them, and they don't want to be there. They don't want to be doing what they're doing, despite what the theme park or aquarium might tell you. So that's so the dolphin mythology of a healer really is something that I encounter quite a lot, and has spurred this big commercial industry of interactive programs. The other thing I want people to know is that dolphins and whales cannot thrive in captivity. And that has everything to do with the kind of animal they are, their evolutionary history, and the kinds of adaptations that they have. And despite any good intentions, there is really no way to provide for those things in a theme park or aquarium. So, of course, their welfare is extremely poor, and they live very short lives in theme parks and aquaria.
Lori, that's what I wanted to get to right now is, speaking of aquariums such as the Vancouver Aquarium, they say that they need to take in cetaceans that need to be rehabilitated, but then they keep them there in tiny cramped conditions for the rest of their lives and performing shows and tricks for people. So I'm wondering if the sanctuary were to exist, or when it does come into existence in a few years, is that going to negate the need for the Vancouver Aquarium according to their own mandate?
I don't think it will negate the need for the aquarium, though what we're hoping is that it requires them to change their business model to become, you know, much more authentic in what they do. I mean, but one of the things that we're hoping to provide with the sanctuary is rehab. And that's really important because you said it yourself. Typically now, when there's a stranding or an injured animal, a dolphin or whale, an aquarium or theme park might get that animal and nurse them back to health, but then they have a vested interest in making sure that animal never goes back out to sea again. They end up in show business, I call it. You know, the one-way ticket to show business is the strand. And we want to provide an alternative to that. We won't be invested in holding back any stranded or injured or sick animals from returning to the sea if that's what's best for them. So, yes, we will be providing an alternative to what theme parks and aquaria currently do.
Well, I'm wondering if you are in talks with aquariums such as the Vancouver Aquarium, or what has been their feedback on this project, or are you working together and trying to cooperate with them?
Well, one, we haven't been in active talks with them yet. They know about us, and they know that we are looking in the vicinity of the Vancouver Aquarium, though it may end up being on the East Coast or somewhere else. We don't know yet. We're still in the site selection process. And, you know, I don't expect them to be promoting or supporting what we're doing at this point because it may threaten their business in their minds, when in fact, you know, from our point of view, we are not trying to impact businesses and close down aquaria. We're trying to build a sanctuary. And if they were willing, if the Vancouver Aquarium or any aquarium were willing to work with us on that, we would welcome them. So this is not, we don't see this as adversarial. We see this as providing something that needs to exist, and hoping that the aquariums will come on board eventually.
Dr. Marino, you co-authored a groundbreaking study in 2001 that offered evidence of mirror self-recognition in bottlenose dolphins. And after this study was published, you decided to stop conducting research on captive animals. Can you elaborate on this a little bit more? What was it about this research experience that led you to this decision?
Well, the research was done at the New York Aquarium in Brooklyn, in Coney Island. And Diana Reese and I studied two bottlenose dolphins who were born into captivity. And they were sort of young teenagers then, older teenagers. And we conducted a study and were able to show unequivocally that these two dolphins were able to recognize themselves in mirrors. And up to that point, only great apes and humans were able to show this capacity. And this capacity is somehow related to self-awareness, the ability to say, well, there's a me here, you know, there's a sense of I or me, an autobiographical sense, if you will. And so we completed the study, and we concluded that the two dolphins passed the test and were self-aware. And then two things happened. One is that, it took a while for this to happen, but I started to think about what it meant to be self-aware and living in a concrete tank going around and around and around for years and years and years. And I began to really take into account what my findings actually, what the implications of my findings were, not just for the science, but for the ethics of what was happening to these animals if they were self-aware. And then a couple of years after that, they were transferred to another facility, and both of them died at very young ages. So the combination of that and also finding out about the connection between the captivity industry and the Taiji dolphin hunts and all of that just converged together, and I realized that, you know, it was extremely important for me to do something, to use my training to give back to these animals what has been taken from them.
That's fantastic. Do you anticipate the whale sanctuary being useful for research on cetaceans?
We are not planning to do any research on them there because they've already been exploited enough, and we hope that this is a place where they can truly be as autonomous as possible, do what they want, where they want, when they want, and not be imposed upon. There will be some kinds of procedures that we will have to do with them just to keep them healthy and fed and safe. And down the line, there may be some research that, you know, is entirely non-intrusive, non-invasive, that if we deem it important for conservation purposes, we will do. But right now, we are planning this to be an authentic sanctuary and a public display facility.
That's great. So I think I didn't mention this before. Our listeners may or may not be aware that you appeared in the wildly successful documentary Blackfish, right? And your expertise was consulted for that. I'm wondering, have you noticed since that movie came out, have you noticed kind of a change in overall public attitudes toward cetaceans and sympathy for cetaceans?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, Blackfish had a tremendous impact, more than any of us anticipated, including the filmmakers. And it continues to have an impact. It's been the kind of film that has revealed something to the public that they didn't know before. And now that they know, the public has become really sensitive to the issues of welfare for orcas and other cetaceans in theme parks like SeaWorld. And it has definitely made a tremendous difference. We are hoping that that public shift in consciousness continues.
Absolutely. Yeah, I find it so exciting that the whale sanctuary may be right here in our own city of Vancouver. That's really cool, or very close to it. Last but not least, what can our listeners do to get involved with or support the Whale Sanctuary Project?
Well, right now, number one, they can just tell everybody about it, but the second thing, or maybe not the second, but in addition, they can go to our website at www.whalesanctuaryproject.org. And they can check out, you know, what we're doing, who's on the team. We'll post blogs and updates. And we also have a Facebook page and a Twitter page. And, you know, if they feel that they want to get involved in any other way, then they can just email us and be happy to answer questions and so forth. So, you know, right now we are... a lot of people, a lot of the public is very on board with this, very supportive, very enthusiastic. We're very grateful for that. And we just ask them, you know, to stay involved.
Yeah, and are you accepting donations as well?
Yes, we are accepting donations. And you can do that through our website.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for coming on Animal Voices today, Lori, and sharing your insight and expertise on cetaceans with us. We're so excited about the Whale Sanctuary Project. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
So if you would like more information on the Whale Sanctuary Project, again, visit www.whalesanctuaryproject.org. You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us here next Friday, June 10th. Allison, can you tell us what will be on next week's show?
Well, did you both hear about the fantastic lobster rescue that happened this week in Red Lake, Ontario?
Yes.
An activist, a fellow vegan, I should say. Her name is Christine Loheed. She lives in Red Lake, Ontario. She found this lobster, didn't want him to die, saved him, shipped him to Halifax, where he was released into the ocean to live out the rest of his life. June 15th is Save a Lobster Day.
Oh, nice.
Fortunately. So that's who we'll be having on our show next week is Christine to elaborate on her story. And I'm so excited to have her here to share about, you know, we often don't hear good animal news. This is a happy story. So we'll be sharing that happy story with you
next
week.
And I want to hear about the fabled immortality of lobsters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're talking. They live very, very long lives, right? Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, that'll be exciting. That's next Friday at noon here on 100.5 FM. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit our website at animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows or download them as podcasts. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links and subscribe to us on iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook, facebook.com/animalvoicesvancouver. And on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. We are currently looking for volunteers to produce, co-host, operate the control room, help with website maintenance and social media, and more. If you have skills and interests in any of these areas, as well as a passion for animal advocacy, please do drop us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Training will be provided. So now we will leave you with a song. As many of you may know, I'm a classical musician myself, so I chose a piece today that's a little bit of a departure from our normal closing songs here on Animal Voices. This is Franz Schubert's classic art song Die Forelle, or The Trout, sung by baritone Robert Hohl with David Lutz on piano. It's a very interesting little song about someone watching a beautiful trout in a stream and being very upset when someone tries to hurt him. It's rather unusual for something that was written in the 1800s. So hope you enjoy it. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
In einem Bächlein helle, da schoss in froher Eil die launische Forelle vorüber wie ein Pfeil. Ich stand an dem Gestade und seine süße Ruh des muntern Fischleins bade im klaren Bächlein zu. Des muntern Fischleins bade im klaren Bächlein zu. Ein Fischer mit der Rute wohl an dem Ufer stand und saß mit kaltem Blute, wie sich das Fischlein wand. So lang dem Wasser helle, so dacht ich nicht gebricht, so fängt er die Forelle mit seiner Angel nicht. So fängt er die Forelle mit seiner Angel nicht. Doch endlich ward dem Diebe die Zeit zu lang. Er macht das Bächlein tückisch trübe und es gedacht, so zuckte seine Rute, das Fischlein zappelt an, und ich mit regem Blute sah die Betrugne an, und ich mit regem Blute sah die Betrugne an.